This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Unless pandemics become commonplace, 2020 will be a year that will be talked about for generations. We've experienced a worldwide health emergency that has claimed millions of lives and has disrupted almost every aspect of what we consider normal, while spurring the development of innovative vaccines to bring COVID-19 under control. Healthcare professionals remain on the front lines of the pandemic. Today we'll begin with a conversation from the Prairie Pulse television show featuring the Chief Medical Officer for Essentia Health in Eastern North Dakota and Western Minnesota. Dr. Richard Vetter visited with host John Harris about vaccines and the pandemic experience.
Dr. Vetter, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
How are the vaccinations going through Essentia right now?
The vaccination has been going very well. We've been ramped up, and we've made a commitment to our patients and our community to really be able to staff up to whatever level we need to provide vaccines. So as soon as we get the vaccine allocations from our state health department, we're getting those out to the patients as fast as possible. And I think if you followed the news, North Dakota has really led the nation in our ability to take the vaccines that have been allocated and getting them distributed in a very quick turnaround. And Essentia has been committed to continuing to do that. We've been doing about 1,600 vaccinations a day over the past several months.
Yeah. Well, which vaccines do you have the most of? Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer?
So we basically get the allocations from the state. Pfizer is probably the most common one that we get. We also get a fair number of Moderna vaccine supply, as well as the last 2 weeks, then we've been getting Johnson & Johnson as well. And those allocations are being ramped up as we speak.
Well, and you talk about that with supplies coming in. Do you know when they're coming, or how does all that work?
Yeah, so the health department typically on the Thursday, Friday of the preceding week will say how many allocations we're going to be receiving. You know, one of the challenges with COVID vaccination has really been the two-dose series. So you have to time and know when people are due for their first dose, but then also get them scheduled for their second dose and making sure that we have supply to do those second doses as well. And that's added a little layer of complexity, but we've been able to navigate that with the help of our electronic record and the state's help. But they will allocate the end of the week, and then we put the schedules out for the next week to get people vaccinated, and usually do it over a 2 to 3 day period.
Have you been seeing any adverse reactions to any of the doses?
Like most vaccines, there's always some minor reactions, you know, a little bit of arm soreness, low-grade fever, feeling a little bit tired, maybe some muscle soreness, usually just a day or two. Most of them are self-limiting and pass. We've had a couple people that have had to miss work because of more significant reactions. Serious side effects, though, have been extremely rare. You know, when the vaccines first came out, there was a concern about severe allergic reactions or anaphylaxis. And really, that hasn't panned out to be a big issue. We do still monitor individuals for 15 minutes, or if they have a history of allergies, for 30 minutes post-vaccination. But almost never do we have to intervene or provide any sort of assistance or transfer them to the emergency room, as an example. If you look at the national data, over 130 million doses have been administered now of the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, and the incidence of severe allergic reaction has been less than 5 per million. So, I mean, it's exceedingly rare.
Well, it is. And, you know, of course, it was rolled out and different people could go get vaccinations depending on their health and age. But now it seems like we're probably going to open up and you can just get an appointment if you want to take the vaccine.
Yeah, and I think that's been one of the other logistical challenges, has been trying to go through the prioritization groups that the health department laid out. I think it was still the right approach, but it started with those at most highest risk, so healthcare workers, long-term care residents, people that work in long-term care. We know that that's where the biggest risk of COVID infection has been, and the number of deaths have been from those facilities. So I think getting the healthcare workers, long-term care residents, and then other high-risk individuals, and then now we're into the essential worker group. And then as of Monday, the state's going to open it up and allow the general public to start beginning vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. You know, by what time do you think all Ascensia patients, and for that matter, maybe everybody in our region, will at least have been offered a chance to come in and get a vaccine?
It depends on the availability, but as I said earlier, the availability of vaccines has been ramping up every week. We see more and more allocations, and so we're going to continue to do our best to get those out. I would anticipate that really by mid to late May, end of the school year, we should have everybody vaccinated that wants to receive a vaccine.
Yeah, with that said, and you talked about, why do you think the vaccines have been rolled out so quickly, and what factors did contribute to this?
I know that there's been a lot of concern, safety concern, around that rapid release. And I think if you know the details behind it, it might help some allay some of those fears. We know that the technology, particularly for the Moderna and Pfizer, that messenger RNA technology was starting to be developed even with the Ebola outbreak several years ago. So the technology, the platform, was already there. The other thing that the government did is took a risk. They said to the manufacturers, we'll buy the vaccine up front, just make it, with the bet that the vaccine would turn out to be efficacious and safe. If it wouldn't have been, they would have just discarded those, and the manufacturers wouldn't have been on the hook for that outlay of financial input. So the government taking on that risk, really they started making the vaccines as soon as they had them in the pipeline. The other piece is that the RNA structure of the virus was identified early on, back in January. So even before we had our first case in the U.S., we knew the genetic sequence of that virus. So we knew the genetic sequence. We could make the vaccines using that technology. Really, by the time we saw our first case, the vaccine was already developed and then just had to go through the trials.
You know, there are some people out there that are still concerned, even though we're now weeks and even months into the vaccine being distributed. What can you say, speak to that?
I think a couple things. First of all, as I mentioned, 130 million doses have already been given of the Pfizer and Moderna products. We've seen very few adverse side effects of any significant degree. We know that the efficacy studies show that those two are 94% to 95% effective in preventing COVID infection. So we know they're efficacious. We know that they're safe, at least in the short term. If you look at how the technology is developed, knowing the vaccine biology, really the risk to the individual should be exceedingly low, because that messenger RNA that's put in there that produces the protein, those spike proteins people might have heard about, the messenger RNA is inserted, goes into your cell. Your cellular process produces protein based off that little template, and that messenger RNA is degraded relatively quickly, just like it is with your natural messenger RNA. It doesn't last very long, and those proteins then get distributed to this outside of the cell. Your body recognizes those as foreign and develops an immune response. So the technology is very unique, but knowing that biology, the risk should be exceedingly low. I know there's a lot of myths out there about vaccine. You know, will it cause infertility is a common one I've heard. Again, knowing the vaccine biology, there's really no reason why that should be so. In fact, the American College of OBGYN is actually recommending that pregnancy, we know that those people are at increased risk of COVID morbidity and mortality. So they're actually recommending their pregnant patients talk to their doctors and providers about getting vaccinated. And there's ongoing studies looking at that pregnant population. The other thing that post-marketing that the government does and the CDC does is they monitor safety. And so they have a vaccine reporting system for adverse events. Those of us that have been vaccinated actually got an app on our phone that we could report back on. They would send a text message, you report how you're feeling. And so they're developing other new ways of developing that safety data that hopefully should give people some peace of mind.
Okay. So is this vaccine going to end up being like a flu shot? Yeah. That we have to get every year, or how much do we know about that?
Yeah, at this point, I would say we really don't know. You know, we don't know how long the natural infection will actually provide natural immunity. We don't really know how long the vaccine will produce, whether it'll produce lifelong immunity or not. It may or may not. We don't know what the booster series may or may not look like. So there's a lot we're going to learn over the next year or two. But I have no doubt that our researchers will give us that data when it's available, and we'll be able to adjust or modify how we treat our patients.
You know, in the news, we're hearing a lot about the variants now and I guess mutations or whatever, you know, and how they're going to react. to the various vaccines. What's the data showing on that?
Yeah, so we knew and we know that viruses in general try to get around our mitigation strategies. So whether it's hand hygiene or using different medications, they continue to mutate and try to outsmart us and try to work a way around that. And we know that's going to happen with vaccines as well. And so far, the initial studies show that the current vaccines actually do provide some protection against the variants. But I think that's one of the other reasons why we want to try to vaccinate as quickly as possible to not allow that virus to continue to mutate and change and figure out a way around our vaccines. And then the vaccine manufacturers are going to continue then again to use that technology, that new RNA, insert it in and develop new vaccines in a really rapid turnaround to be able to adapt to that changing virus.
You talked about North Dakota being very good at rolling out the vaccine, and it seems that you're right on that. But so let's back up to, you know, we were also number one in cases at one point. What was the peak time for your COVID units at Essentia? Was it last fall or when?
Yeah, it was kind of mid-November. Yeah. You know, started to ramp up beginning of November. Mid-November was kind of our peak, and then started to decline after that. And over the past, really post-holiday season, that number has remained relatively steady, up and down a little bit, but pretty steady. We were all worried around the holidays whether or not we would see a second spike, and fortunately that didn't occur. That was the same time, though, that I think some of those other mitigation strategies came into play, which probably helped us as well.
Well, there you go, because, you know, why do you think COVID numbers are remaining low now in North Dakota? Is it the mask wearing or the distancing, of course? Are we reaching herd immunity, as some people suggest? Or is it all the above, or just, you know, what?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all of those things. You know, we know the mitigation strategies, masking, hand hygiene, have some impact at least. We know that when people have been naturally infected, they're going to be protected for a period of time. We know that vaccines are protecting a certain number of people. And then finally, we know that there's some seasonality to viral illnesses as well. And the virus naturally kind of peaks and abates over time. And so I think all those things put together. So it's probably a complex answer, but there's all those factors, I think, play a role.
Can you talk about how your staff responded at Essentia during those peak times of COVID? It had to be stressful.
Yeah, it was extremely stressful, I think, for all people of all walks of life, but particularly in healthcare, where they were having to see patients many times without their loved one because of the visitor restrictions. And so to be there and to watch those people pass away without their loved ones sometimes necessarily being able to be at their side, I think that was particularly hard for some of our staff. We've tried to do a good job about reaching out and providing resources, behavioral health, mental health support for our staff to help them cope with some of these challenges. And I think we've done a reasonably good job of that, but our work's not done. We're going to continue to see, I think, some mental health challenges going forward. Again, not just with our staff, but the public at large. And so we're going to continue to put resources there. I can't be more proud, though, of how our staff stepped up. I think the other thing that helped them a lot, to be honest, is our community support. Seeing the parades that came by the hospital, the stickers on the window, the monetary support, the food support, all those things that the community really did to support our healthcare workers was just outstanding and helped them get through those challenging times.
You've talked a little bit about this, but what do you think some of the big lessons that we learned from the pandemic?
I think one of the main learnings for me is how fast we can adapt when we need to. I think all of us, you know, making significant changes in the way we do our work takes a lot of effort sometimes. And we found that we can actually do this a lot quicker when we needed to do that. I think virtual care was another real learning, that you can actually take good care of people using a virtual platform like telehealth and other going into their home with a video camera and being able to interact and provide health care in a way that was different than what we've done before. So I think that the other piece is really taking a step back and showing empathy when people are stressed. All of us respond to stress different. And so having that ability to really support one another and the community support, Like I said, it just was heartwarming to see how when we put our mind to something, the community will help rally around and help support the effort.
You know, some people ask, what's the best vaccine to take? Do you have an answer for that?
I would say whatever vaccine is available is the best vaccine to take. We know that all three vaccines are highly effective in reducing hospitalization and death, and that's really what we're trying to avoid.
Obviously, you think vaccines should be taken. But you know, unfortunately, or for whatever reasons, you know, people are scared of the vaccine for various reasons. Maybe it came too quickly, or it's political now. You know, what's your advice to somebody who is scared to take a shot?
I would say talk to your healthcare provider about your concerns, why you might be concerned. I think do some research, learn about, you know, how the vaccine was developed. Read about, you know, the number of healthcare workers that are accepting of it. I saw a study the other day, about 90% of doctors have accepted or received the shot. So that should give you some reassurance, hopefully. I think recognizing that over 130 million people have received the vaccine and it's shown to be very safe and very efficacious. And it's really our way out of this pandemic. I think to also think about the broader context, that it's not just about your own personal health or personal protection, but it's really about your family, your community, those at higher risk. How can we best protect them? And the best way we can protect them is by getting vaccinated so that we're not sharing that illness with someone else.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee mask wearing going away once the population's all been vaccinated, or is this something that we might see continue to some degree?
I think it'll be a gradual reduction, probably. I think there will be some businesses or some organizations that may choose to have that in place, which particularly if you can't maintain appropriate distancing and those sorts of things. But I don't think it'll be just all of a sudden we'll wake up one day and masks are gone. I think it'll be a gradual decline in the use. And again, certainly those people at higher risk or those who haven't been vaccinated should continue to consider that as a mitigation strategy.
Well, we look forward to the day that we have some sense of the old normalcy. It'll be a new normal,
new
I guess.
Normal.
Okay. Well, thank you for all the information and thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
John Harris with Dr. Richard Vetter, a chief medical officer with Essentia Health. Their entire conversation airs this evening at 8 Central on the television service of Prairie Public. John's guest next Thursday, April 1st, will be Quinn Jaeger of Clay County Social Services on the occasion of April being Child Abuse Prevention Month. Next on Main Street, Tom Easern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Tom Easern is a distinguished and distinctive voice on our show. He's a professor of history at North Dakota State University, and his special interest is the history of the Great Plains. Today, his Plains Folk essay brings that perspective to agriculture.
If you're a regular listener to Plains Folk, then you know that you're dealing with a farm boy. I'm the guy who buys out other heirs and nurtures hopes of seeing the family farm, dating from 1874, into its seventh generation. I will need more than my biblical 70 to do that, so wish me luck. If you are a regular listener, then, too, you know I am a thoroughgoing academic, and make no bones about it. The history of agriculture and the history of the Great Plains are my wheelhouses. I come by these interests honestly. Thus, I was commissioned to write, for a major publisher, a State of the Discipline essay as a chapter for a reference work in American agricultural history. I just finished it, and over the next couple of weeks, I'll abstract some of my thoughts from the essay, Agriculture of the Great Plains, 8,000 words. Don't worry, you won't get all of them. To begin with, I'm old, and I think in terms of the long game. So the piece starts out by invoking the classic works of the field, all published in 1931. The Populist Revolt by John D. Hicks, who tells the story of the Farmers' Alliance and the Populist Party of the 1890s, which gets me agitated. The Great Plains by Walter Prescott Webb, who establishes the importance of the level, treeless, semi-arid environment for agriculture and everything else on the plains. And The Day of the Cattleman by Ernest Staples Osgood, the classic treatment of the open-range cattle industry. Sometimes my students get a little restive when I make them read these hopelessly out-of-date books, but when they roll their eyes, that is my opportunity to educate them about what we call epistemology, one of those wonky terms of the trade, meaning, simply enough, how we know what we know, knowing where our knowledge comes from. How it has evolved is essential for understanding what we're trying to do as historians, or as farmers, I would argue. 1931, though, is only yesterday in the eye of God, cue Psalm 90, or that of the serious historian. And that brings me to another one of our wonky terms, this one borrowed from the French Annales historians, the longue durée. Or to put it in farm boy terms, the long haul, over time. This means recognizing American Indians as the first and continuing farmers of the plains. In much of the region, we rely on archaeology to fill in our knowledge about the village farming peoples of the distant past. For Kansas and the Central Plains, in fact, the very vicinity of my own family farm interests, we have the excavations and ruminations of Waldo Weedle. Weedle was a Mennonite farm boy himself, and so it is fitting that he is the one who has stretched our knowledge of Great Plains agriculture back to the 1500s and beyond. On the northern plains, we are fortunate to have the remembrances of the Idatsa farmer Mekshitawiya, Buffalo Bird Woman, who told what she knew about traditional Idatsa agriculture to the clergyman anthropologist Gilbert Wilson. This text, Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden, is our greatest written source about Indian agriculture on the prairies. Mekshitawiya schools us in some important insights that guided her life and inform ours. That agriculture need not be the male-dominant occupation that we Euro-Americans make it out to be. That the practice of agriculture should involve the family and community and look out for the well-being of all. And that it is both a necessity and a privilege to live a life attuned to the seasons and the soil.
That's Tom Easern. Coming up on Main Street, a film review and more from Matt Olean, and Easter treat ideas from Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has soundly rejected a bill that would have legalized adult recreational use of marijuana. House Bill 1420 had earlier passed the House. Its supporters say it was designed to head off a potential initiated constitutional measure, which would be more wide open than what the bill would have allowed. The Senate Human Services Committee sent the bill to the Senate floor without committee recommendation. The chairman, Republican Senator Judy Lee of West Fargo, told her colleagues she believes adult marijuana use is coming.
I think that train has left the station. We can see the headlight of that engine coming down the tracks. I would way rather be in the engine driving it than tied to the tracks so they can run over me. We have something we can do here. We can be in control of this train.
Opponents said marijuana is addictive and is, quote, a gateway drug to other narcotics. Bismarck Republican Senator Diane Larson.
It's a wrong thing to do to pass something that we don't like just so that we don't get something we hate.
The bill failed 37-10. North Dakota House Majority Leader Chet Pollard says he won't support a bonding bill at a higher level than the $680 million the House has already passed. The bonding bill is now in the Senate, and Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he would like to add some items to it, bringing the price tag to $860 million. The House version focuses on money for water projects as well as other infrastructure. Wardner's proposal is to add spending for career and technical education centers and some other projects. Pollard says he thinks the $680 million level is as far as he will go.
I think that's a more appropriate level, even though other folks say it's not enough money for infrastructure. But the amendments, and I've told Senator Warner that they're a little more expensive than I'm interested in.
Again, that bonding bill is currently in the Senate. And the legislature has agreed on raises for state employees for the next two-year period. The package calls for 1.5% raises in the first year, with 2% the second year. There is a minimum amount set for those pay increases. Legislators will also get raises of 1.5% and 2%. House Majority Leader Chet Pollard says that's been the practice for at least the last couple of sessions.
I don't think we should be getting more than they are. Maybe some folks will disagree with that, but that puts us in par with what the wages are for state employees.
The pay plan is now being added to each agency's budget bill. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, you went to a movie I don't know anything about, Pieces of a Woman.
Pieces of a Woman, it is on Netflix, and Vanessa Kirby got a Best Actress nomination for this movie. She is a British actress, and I would say a star to watch. She has a great look on camera. She's wonderful in this movie. There is some talk that her chances of winning have maybe been diminished a little bit by Shia LaBeouf's, her co-star, his off-screen abuse allegations, which is a whole nother story. But suffice it to say that it didn't help with the publicity out there that he was being accused by multiple women of abuse. But in this movie, they play a couple, a young couple, married couple, and they are going through a childbirth. And basically, the first 30 minutes of the movie, Doug, deals with an at-home birth as they're trying to deliver her baby with the help of a midwife. The first 30 minutes of this movie are phenomenal. I mean, it's all done in basically one take, Doug, without any editing. So it is intense. You feel like you're actually watching a childbirth. You're not sure what's going to happen. Is this going to work out? Is this not going to work out? And the director, Cornel Mundrusho, from Hungary, he's a Hungarian director, decides to shoot this childbirth scene in one continuous take with three people in the room: Shia LaBeouf, Vanessa Kirby, and the actress playing the midwife.
Wow.
Now, it's intense. It's as intense as anything I've seen all year on screen. But I would say the problem with the movie, Doug, is where does the movie go after that? And I'm not going to tell people what happens with the childbirth, but in a movie, if you put all your cards on the table in the first 30 minutes with basically the dramatic scene, where does the rest of the 90 minutes go? And I felt like the rest of the movie did not live up to the first 30 minutes. As we kind of have the aftermath of this childbirth, what's happening with the couple, what's happening with her family as they reach out to her. And the rest of the film is not bad. It just felt like a series of scenes that don't really add up to anything. And I kept wanting a little bit more of a character study, a little bit more closure, a little bit more, you know, what's going on with these people's lives, what's going to happen in the aftermath of the childbirth, that kind of thing. And it just didn't live up to the first 30 minutes. In fact, it almost feels like a whole different movie from then on out. Not bad, like I said, just not satisfactory to me anyway. There's also some problems with the age difference between Vanessa Kirby and Ellen Burstyn. Now, Ellen Burstyn is 88 years old now, and she plays Vanessa Kirby's mother. Vanessa Kirby's 32 years old. It just does not add up. Ellen is great. She's an Oscar-winning actress. We love her. She's fantastic as her very, very worried mother. But again, the age difference is so striking, it just doesn't feel right. Another thing, too, is the coupling of Shia LaBeouf and Vanessa Kirby never feels right to me. They seem like a mismatched couple. She's very elegant. She comes from money. She dresses nice, has a college degree. He works in a shipyard. And you're just wondering, in terms of money class and things like that, we know how that works, Doug, in life. Most people marry kind of people within their own class, and that's just the way it is. And I'm not saying it can't happen the other way, but they seem like a very mismatched couple in the movie. That didn't quite ring true for me as well, but it's worth seeing for one reason only, and that's Vanessa Kirby's performance. She just digs so deep in this performance. I'm really happy she got an Oscar nomination. I don't think she's going to win. I don't think the film is strong enough, especially when you put it up against Carey Mulligan's Promising Young Woman and Frances McDormand's Nomadland, but still worth a look. I will caution viewers, Doug, it's a tough view to watch this childbirth going on, then I really would recommend people not watch it because it's a difficult scene to watch. I'm not going to lie to you. And if people can't handle that, even though you know it's a movie, then I would say maybe just shy away from this one. But if you want to see some really good acting and kind of an interesting look to the film, I thought the Hungarian director kind of filmed it, even though it takes place in Boston, it kind of has almost this foreign film look to it. Which is probably because he's from Hungary, and it just has a different feel to it. And so I liked the first, 30, 40 minutes of it, and then I didn't think it quite lived up to the all-cards-on-the-table approach to the movie, which happens in the first 30 minutes.
Okay. I'm intrigued by the movie just because of the way you described it, and particularly the first 30 minutes, because are you saying there are no edits? It's one camera shot?
The first scene of the movie, you see Shia LaBeouf working at a shipyard. They're building a bridge, basically. And then once the childbirth starts, it's one continuous take. He comes home, and then we go through this home birth. And it is gripping. It is just crazy to watch. It's amazing that they pulled this off. And the acting is true. It's real. You feel like you're right there with Vanessa Kirby as she's trying to give birth. So it's an amazing piece of filmmaking once that home birth begins.
Well, it's a movie I'll check out. My Oscar trivia question is a very simple one because you basically answered it as you were talking about the movie. Who is the only Oscar winner tied to the movie Pieces of a Woman?
And that's Ellen Burstyn, who won Best Actress for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore in 1974.
Now let's talk about this big watch party that's coming up, Matt. I did not realize that this documentary about the Class B in North Dakota was 20 years old.
Yeah, it's the first documentary I ever produced, Doug, here at Prairie Public, and it's still one that I hear a lot from people. They just really liked it. It was exhausting. We had to get a lot of film clips. And yes, Sunday at 5 p.m., a watch party through Prairie Public, and you can go on Prairie Public's social media platforms and sign up to watch it. And I'll be there as well so I can answer questions and comment on how amazing it was to make this movie. We just had the State B boys basketball tournament last weekend. Kindred won it all. And it remains a big deal in this state. I don't think it's quite as big a deal as it used to be, Doug, because there's been so much consolidation of schools. And sometimes the private schools like the Dickinson Trinities and the Shiloh Christians, I think they have an advantage because they're able to kind of recruit within these big cities. So I think that's maybe watered down the State B just a bit. But hopefully people will watch this. If you haven't seen it, Sunday at 5 on Prairie Public. And you can go on our social media platforms and sign up to watch it.
The title of the documentary is One Shining Moment, The History of the North Dakota State Bee. It's 90 minutes long. And Matt, you said it was your first documentary for Prairie Public. How long have you been at Prairie Public?
23 years now, Doug. 1998 is when I left KXJB Television, where many of us worked in the old days. So 23 years now, yeah.
And what do you remember most about making the documentary now 20 years later?
Finding all the players and coaches I needed was a bit of work. This is, before everyone was on Facebook and things like that. So it was a little tricky finding everyone, but I found most of the people I wanted. But I think the journeys to Hillsboro and Epping and some of these places we went to interview the former players, the former coaches, those were the best times about shooting that documentary, just hanging out with the players and the coaches as they talked about these memorable moments of their lives.
Mentioned KXJB, they carried a lot of the Class B tournaments, and there must be some great vintage moments.
Yes, we hear our old buddy Jim Adelson quite a bit throughout this documentary commenting. He has one hilarious part where Ed Beyer, the old Hillsboro coach, is yelling at some of his players. And Jim goes, "I don't think I'd want Eddie mad at me." So he always had those nice little lines he would throw in like that. So it was good to see that.
And there's an Epping story that I think I've heard in the promotion about this documentary.
Yeah, 1977, Epping played Hillsboro for the state title. Epping had 23 kids in grades 9 through 12, and they made the state title game because they had two sets of brothers who could play basketball, and it was a Cinderella story. They didn't quite win it, but the fact that they got that far was amazing, and everybody in Bismarck at the Civic Center was pulling for Epping, unless you were from Hillsboro.
Well, it's this Sunday at 5 on our television service. That's 5 Central. One Shining Moment, the history of the North Dakota State Bee. And Matt Aline will also be involved in that Facebook watch party. Matt, we should mention the passing of another pretty well-known performer.
Yeah, George Siegel, huge star in the 70s and 60s, Doug, as you and I both know. Light romantic comedies is what George really specialized in. A Touch of Class with he and Glenda Jackson. The Owl and the Pussycat with Barbara Streisand. Bloom and Love was a good one. He did some good heist movies, too, like The Hot Rock with Robert Redford and California Split. Got his Oscar nomination for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He was the last of the four cast members. As you know, Doug, there's only four people in that movie, and he was the last living cast member from that movie. King Rat, I think, is probably my favorite dramatic performance of his from 1965, and he worked right to the end. He was on the Goldbergs. And this was complications from heart surgery, so he was working right to the end. Also an important guy, too, Doug. He was one of the first Jewish leading men on screen who did not have to change his last name. And that was an important barrier that was broken there because Kirk Douglas, as you know, is not Kirk Douglas's real name. It's Iser Danielovich. So a lot of Jewish leading men actors had to change their last names because of how things were. But George Siegel didn't, and that was an important, I think, moment there.
George Siegel died Tuesday at the age of 87. We've been to the movies with Matt Aline.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
March is National Nutrition Month. This year, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics encourages everyone to personalize your plate. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to nutrition and health. We are all unique with different bodies, goals, backgrounds, and tastes. For individualized nutrition advice, consult a registered dietitian nutritionist who can tailor a helpful eating plan that's as special as you are. To learn more, visit eatright.org or follow hashtag National Nutrition Month on social media. A public service message from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
And Sue joins us once a week for Main Street Eats from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
We're coming up on a big holiday, not too far away from Easter, which, you know, is one of those moving around holidays. What is it, the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox? Did I get that right? I think that's what it definitely has something to do with moon cycles.
I just go to the calendar.
I was talking to somebody just the other day, and I was like, well, you know, the meteorological spring has already happened, but we don't usually have spring. Until the 21st or something like that, you know. But I couldn't say the word meteorological. I couldn't get the word out to save my life. So I have to rely on Doug to keep us straight with those holidays. But I love Easter. Easter is like the foretelling of spring. Mm. And I was born on a Good Friday. And so I always look to the years that Easter falls on my birthday so I can get a bigger cake, you know, like a bigger bunny cake. But as a Christian, there are many, 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 many Christian traditions that surround Easter that have everything to do with food. And one of those, of course, is Easter bread, which we did in my family. And I always go out to the grocery stores after Christmas and buy up all of the candied fruit that didn't sell for fruitcake because nobody makes fruitcake anymore, and buy it for Easter bread. So I just have a stash in my freezer. And as you know, Easter bread is a sweet bread. You know, it's an enriched dough, so it has lots of eggs and sugar in it. And then it's filled with almonds or pecans and raisins and candied citrus, you know, like candied lemon peel, which I just love. Candied cherries give it some color. And then it's baked, and good luck with this. It's baked in a coffee can so that it towers up, and then it has kind of a little mushroom top on it, which has an X cross kind of cut into the top of it that it kind of grows as it's baked, signifying, I'm sure, the holiday. And then it's covered with a wonderful powdered sugar frosting that you can make in any color you want to kind of match your Easter eggs. But the problem nowadays is finding a coffee can. So please don't use a plastic Folgers can in your oven.
Right. Not a good idea.
Not a good idea. And that's a little bit disappointing to not be able to find a can. But there are those food size or commercial size cans that you can get green beans and things in. So if you go to somebody who cooks, like our church cooks big meals for Wednesday nights, you can always get those great big cans. And those, well, they kind of work, but they're a little, you have to put probably the whole batch in one can. But I love Easter bread. That's one of my favorite things.
In the parts of the world where wheat is, you know, abundant and bread is everywhere, every ethnic tradition, or for that matter, nationality, seems to have a sweet bread that they favor, particularly around certain holidays.
Right. And so Easter bread is Russian, but hot cross buns. And I was going to look this up. Do you remember that poem, One a Penny, Two a Penny, Hot Cross Buns?
Mm-hmm.
That was something we learned as a child. And actually, hot cross buns are British, or they're from that part of Europe anyway. And they have a huge history of weirdness surrounding them. I think that they've made them on the Great British Baking Show. And so a hot cross bun was originally baked by a monk on Good Friday. And of course, they were symbolic of the, you know, the holiday, the upcoming holiday. And so they had that cross in them, and you can cut that cross in them. But for hot cross buns, sometimes they make a paste out of flour and water, and they actually put that in that cut that they make so that it really, really becomes a significant part of the bun. But there's this, all this weird stuff, like they're supposed to stay fresh. If you hang one from your rafter on Good Friday, the legend has it that it will remain fresh and mold free for an entire year.
Hmm.
And I'm like, okay. And then they break it up and mix it with water, and it's medicinal. And I'm thinking, maybe it's the penicillin from the mold they didn't see on the bun. I don't know. It just sounded pretty weird to me.
Besides the sweetness of the bread, sometimes there's the way they present it as well. It's sort of an extra step, if you will, to celebrate the holiday, whether you braid it or shape it in some unique way. That becomes kind of a centerpiece of the celebration.
Right. And you've seen them, too, with eggs baked into them. You know, they'll make a wreath, and they'll put actually Easter eggs in there that are baked. And I think you actually eat the eggs. And then there's the bunny-shaped ones. You know, there's clever people that make bunny-shaped ones. Actually, I think in one of the documentaries that PBS did on German cooking, they had this little old lady, and she was folding these bunnies. Like, she had this clever way of cutting a square and twisting it and folding these bunnies and put a couple raisins in for the eyes. the best part about her was her German accent, because she sounded just like my grandmother. I think I actually teared up when I watched her make those bunnies. Easter was huge in our family. I mean, it was like a huge, huge holiday. And we always got more treats then, which, of course, Kuchen was something that we always had at Easter time. And people will ask me why. And I think it's because in the spring, there was more milk and cream to be had. And the chickens start laying again once the days get long. Because I'm sure you've noticed since Christmas, the daylight has been increasingly beautiful. And it's been light way, way early in the morning. And you can go out after work and it's still light. So chickens like that. So they start laying eggs. And so you have eggs and cream and all those really wonderful things you need to make Kuchen. And, you know, besides the sweets, these holidays are also important because, you know, like the Catholics did not eat meat on Fridays, but they ate fish. And then on Good Friday, of course, everybody had prunes and noodles. Like, I think that crossed all sorts of religious boundaries. And I love fruit soup and stewed prunes. But I really love homemade noodles and prunes. And it was like a real big tradition on Good Friday to have that. And then Saturday was kind of like a dull day for everybody, you know, like we're a little downer because of Good Friday is supposed to be a sad day, right? But then on Easter, glorious Easter morning, you know, you get Easter eggs and hot cross buns and caramel rolls and all that good stuff and dinner with your relatives. So it was like, yeah, I like Easter a lot.
Yeah. There's that Easter ham.
Oh, yes. One year for Easter, I used to read all these before the internet. I used to read all the old Women's Day and Family Circle magazines I could get my hands on. And so one year for Easter, my mom and I cooked together. Of course, you probably already gathered that. And I put like the cloves, you know how you put your, and these weren't Cloverdale, those tender Cloverdale hams. These were picnic hams. So they had that thick roll of fat around the outside of them. And we studded that with cloves, you know, before we baked it in the oven, because we thought we were going to do something different this year. And of course, my dad, being as pragmatic and German as anybody could be, he's like, I don't know why anybody would waste their time doing that. And I'm like, well, it kind of looks pretty. And, you know, we wanted to be special for Easter. I don't think it got through the fat actually to the ham. You know, the flavor didn't.
You could smell it.
Yes.
Though.
Yes. And it's a lovely thing. I like cloves, and you can stud cloves in fruit for Christmas and make ornaments that smell really nice too. But those hams, once Easter was over with, made the best ham and potato soup. The leftover ham bone we would cook and make ham and bean soup, ham, bean, and potato soup. It was like so delightful. Yeah, there's nothing I don't like about Easter, including Easter egg hunts. You know, that was a big deal. And sunrise services, of course. That's when you got those hot cross buns and Easter bread, usually with a dyed Easter egg, if you were brave enough to get up at the crack of dawn and go to the services, which I don't think they have them as early as they did back then. But yeah, it's all good.
Well, it's a holiday, and we hope everybody has a great one. And Sue, always a pleasure to have you here for Main Street Eats.
Thank you. Happy Easter to everyone.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Louisiana is known for its floods, so how could its groundwater be disappearing?
You can't convince people in Louisiana that they're going to run out of water, because everywhere they look, they see water.
An investigation reveals why the state could soon face a crisis.
It's not an infinite resource. We have built our water consumption based on the notion that we won't have any real disruptions to supplies.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 25th. The National Society for Crippled Children was founded in 1919 to provide services to disabled children. In 1934, the Society started an Easter Seal campaign to raise money. The campaign was so popular that the society changed its name to Easter Seals in 1967. Every year, Easter Seals chose a poster child to act as an ambassador representing disabled children across the country and to lead the annual Easter Seals campaign. On this date in 1960, Bismarck residents opened the newspaper to see a photograph of the Easter Seals child of 1960, local boy Johnny Kemp. He is shown proudly handing flowers to First Lady Mamie Eisenhower. Johnny was the first child from North Dakota to be selected as Easter Seals Child of the Year. Johnny Kemp was born in 1949. His arms were missing below the elbow, and his legs were missing below the knees. Johnny's parents took this news in stride and decided to make the best life possible for him. Unfortunately, his mother died when he was just a year and a half old. His father continued to raise Johnny like any other boy. With the help of prosthetic limbs, Johnny attended school, played sports, joined the Boy Scouts, and even had his own paper route. Many in North Dakota were beyond proud of Johnny. The state legislature wrote a resolution in his honor. U.S. Senator Milton Young read a letter about Johnny into the congressional record. Governor John E. Davis and Bismarck Mayor Evan Lips also sang his praises. Johnny Kemp moved to Kentucky as a teenager, where he excelled in high school. He graduated from Georgetown University and the Washburn University School of Law. He went on to have a distinguished career as an expert in disability law, working for a prestigious firm in Washington, D.C. He co-founded the American Association of People with Disabilities and received many prestigious awards, including the Dole Leadership Prize from the Robert J. Dole Institute of Politics. In 2011, he became president and CEO of the Viscardi Center, a New York-based nonprofit specializing in the education and employment of people with disabilities. Back when Johnny was a 10-year-old Easter Seals Child of the Year, he had sat in the audience for the keynote speaker at an Easter Seals event when the speaker was none other than Harvey Viscardi Jr. himself, the founder of the Viscardi Center that Johnny would one day lead. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Trista Razor-Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, we'll host our monthly Journalist Roundtable. The legislature is, of course, generating a lot of news. We'll discuss the month's big stories with our news director, Dave Thompson, and special guests, Mike Jacobs of the Grand Forks Herald and Amy Sisk of the Bismarck Tribune. We hope you can join us for Main Street and our Journalist Roundtable. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.